I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton, I'm a
man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Hey, how are you doing, Podcats? Adam Buxton here. Welcome to podcast number 39, which this week features a conversation between myself, Garth Jennings, friend of the podcast, film director, etc., and actor and sometime Mighty Boosh member, Julian Barrett, who, along with Garth and his family, came to stay with us last year, towards the end of last year, in October 2016. We had a fun weekend. And while the children were running around and partners were otherwise occupied, the three of us snuck out to take Rosie for a walk around the fields near our house, where I am right now, in fact. Once again, taking Rosie for a walk, this time on a blustery April evening in 2017. Just approaching the cow field. The cows are back! And I've got cow fear. So, Rose, let's walk back this way. Rosie, don't totally ignore me. Let's go this way. There you go. Good girl. I'm stepping on the bracken. Oh, that is crunchy. Oh, bracken. Delicious crunchy bracken. I love my bracken. Delicious crunchy bracken between my feet. Anyway, where was I? Ooh. Right, we were walking, myself, Garth, and Julian last October. We had three little mic packs that I have, and we recorded the conversation that way. The first time, I think, that we've had a three-way conversation on the podcast. That's interesting, Buckles. Thank you so much for telling me. You're welcome. And we enjoyed a properly rambly conversation about, amongst other things, dog turds and funny names, for example. Julian's film we talked about, Mindhorn, which had just been shown for the first time at the London Film Festival at that point. Mindhorn, which he wrote with Simon Farnaby, another terrific and very funny actor, comes out in the UK on May the 5th. Looking forward to seeing that very much. Here's a little bit of blurb about Mindhorn. When MI5 Special Operative Bruce Mindhorn was captured in the late 1980s, his eye was replaced by a super-advanced optical lie detector, which meant he could literally see the truth. He escaped and fled to the Isle of Man to recuperate in the island's temperate microclimate, and today has become the best plainclothes detective the island has ever seen. So we talk a little bit about Mindhorn. And we also talk about Garth's film. Regular listeners to this podcast will have heard Garth talking about the making of the film at various points. And now it is, of course, done and dusted. When we were speaking last October, the film had just been finished but hadn't yet been released. It came out earlier this year in the UK and it did very well. Sing. In fact, I just texted Garth a few minutes ago. And I said I needed some stats for the podcats. Podcats love stats. And he texted back, Sing has now crossed the $620 million mark worldwide. $620 would have been perfectly respectable. But $620 million is better. Well done. Good result. I mean, I got a chortle award, but whatever. Garth continues, I got a bonus, and we bought a new mattress. After 15 years, the old mattress was relieved to go. Probably Garth listened to me talking to Richard Ayoade about the importance of swapping out old pillows and mattresses at regular points. Garth continues, a sequel to Sing, has been announced and is due for release in 2019. I'm writing at the moment, and we begin storyboarding in May. So there you go, that's Garth's news. And Garth also told us in this conversation about what it was like to work on the final stages of Sing at George Lucas's Skywalker Ranch in California. Kind of the film equivalent of Graceland and Neverland rolled into one, but a bit more tasteful, I get the impression. Garth tells us a bit about what it's like there. We also chatted briefly about one of my favourite topics, dealing with negative criticism. And we touched on some other bits and pieces in a semi-coherent and ill-informed manner. So, join myself, Garth Jennings, and Julian Barrett for a nice country walk. Here we go!
Is Rosie mic'd up?
Rosie's mic'd up. She has an internal mic. So it's possible to hear what Rosie's thinking at any point.
I mean, she is good, though. She doesn't run off.
Did she initially try and leave?
Yeah, she would run off and...
not know where she was? Or...
well, you wouldn't know if she was going to come back, and the worry is that she would go into the road, chasing after a little monkjack deer.
Mm.
And the other thing is that she might get cornered by one of the creatures that she's chasing and get duffed in.
What, like an animal ambush?
Well, no, she might get pinned up against a fence or something by a deer. And then,
oh, I see, sorry.
And then, yeah, you're just laughing at the prospect of Rosie being duffed in.
But when you say pinned up, it's like, I'm thinking of Han Solo running after all those stormtroopers and then finding out, oh, there's loads of them.
Yeah.
And then,
and then running back,
Oh, yeah.
She's got the good life, though. You know, she has got to check her privilege every single day.
Yeah.
The lives of some dogs. Yes, they may be free and easy and having fun.
In Shoreditch.
In Shoreditch.
Our dog doesn't even like going for a walk.
You used to have a giant dog, right?
It wasn't giant, but it was bigger than Rosie, yeah.
Wolfie.
Wolfie was a wirehead Vizsla. Mm-hmm. But we live in a flat in France and it wasn't fair. Yeah, and there was nowhere. Paris parks in general don't like you to even walk on the grass, let alone take your dog out on it. So that's why there's so much dog poo in the streets.
Yeah. Do you go out with bags and...
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, always. And I'd say almost everyone I see out with a dog does the same thing. Then almost all the ones you see are good.
Have you ever had to improvise because you didn't have any bags?
No, but I heard you talking to Tash.
Tash Dimitriou,
and she was saying that her dad would pick it up with his bare hands, give it a little squeeze.
Why?
I don't know.
Just check for...
no, because he wasn't prepared to leave the dog plops on the street.
It's admirable.
No, but why squeeze for...
oh, I don't know,
because... density, just
she may have been exaggerating, but yeah, I think he was just enjoying the sensation of the warm parcel.
Wow. Rosie did a small poo outside your barn yesterday.
Right.
And then you were walking out, and I sort of said to you, Rosie did a little poo there. And then I thought you were thinking that I was saying you should clean that up.
Oh.
But I was actually just saying, notifying you so you don't tread in it.
Sure.
Then I thought, obviously here, that you're out in the countryside, you don't pick up after your dog. But and then I thought perhaps you were thinking, oh, he's bringing his city rules to bear upon me now. Kind of. But was that happening? No.
Oh, not in the least. And we do try to pick up.
For that.
The arrangement. No. The arrangement was always that we would pick up Rosie's tots.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Even in the outdoor...
yeah. Even in the outdoor area. The thing is, they dry out after a couple of days and then you can just flick them into the bushes.
Just pick them up.
Pick them up, play around with them a little bit, juggle with them and then discard them. Julian, you're much more mindful of... this is going to sound weird, or it's going to sound like I had a bad impression of you initially, which is not the case. I'll put this in context. I went to Julian's premiere, Garth. I'm talking to you now.
Yeah. Hello.
for his film Mindhorn.
Which I haven't seen yet, but I'm very excited about.
And it was at the London Film Festival. And I came along with my two boys, Frank and Nat. And we got to the Odeon Leicester Square, so we drove from Norwich.
Yeah.
And it was quite exciting, and we saw Edgar Wright ahead of us with Dave Walliams and various folks that I hadn't seen for a while. And we get into the cinema, and we swish upstairs, go and find our seats. And as we're sitting down, this guy comes over and says, Excuse me, can I have a word with you, sir? Can you come with me, please? Which is never good, is it? I mean, it's either like, it always crosses my mind, they're going to say, we've got a special executive booth. Yeah. A special place, because you're too good for this seat that you've been given. So we've got a nice, nice room for people like you, because I think you know the star of this film, don't you? I think maybe it was even the star of this film, Julian Barrett, that invited you to the film. So you come with me to the special, special place.
I thought that's maybe what it was going to be. And I think I even looked at the boys and raised my eyebrows like, hello. Get ready for the special place.
This is making it much worse. Oh, my goodness.
And then we went out into the foyer. And this guy says, sir, how old is your son? And so I just lied, because I was like, okay, here we go. We're going with this, are we? I said, he's 15 and 15. And he said, no, he's not 15. He can't come into the film, I'm afraid, sir. He's too young to see the film. I was like, what? No, it's fine. I'm his dad. I say it's fine. No, it's a 15 film. He can't come in if it's a 50. He's younger than 15. I said, well, look, I'm pretty sure the BBFC... I went for the BBFC.
You went straight for the rule book.
Because in the past, I have looked it up, but clearly I misremembered.
Yeah.
But I said, I think BBFC says it's up to the parent to decide whether a child under 15 goes to... No, it's not, sir. Anyway, I Googled it later on. Indeed, that is not the case. No 15, under 15s allowed in a 15
sure.
film.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mindhorn, at that point, was rated 15. But I just was completely blindsided, hadn't even considered that might be a possibility. And so I thought, okay, well, Julian's going to be here. I'll give him a
Julian
call.
Julian will sort it out.
And I thought, but I hesitated, because obviously when you're a day like that, there's going to be lots of people you know, and
yeah.
It's going to be stressful in all sorts of ways. You haven't seen the film in front of a big audience yourself. And
yeah.
So I really didn't want to give you a call and give you another bit of hassle, but I thought, well, I've got to try. Long story short, though, it didn't work out, and
You rejected.
We were rejected. I was pleased that I managed to keep my shit together a little bit. I didn't totally have a meltdown.
Right.
Which is unusual for me. Yeah. And then also, brilliantly, I didn't take it out on the boys later on and ruin their day.
Well done.
In order to create some kind of payback.
Yes, for being younger than they should have been.
Yeah, for someone else doing something nasty to me. But anyway, the whole point of this long story is that Julian, you were very, very... You went above and beyond the call of duty to apologise, and you were very concerned and distressed about it.
Well, you travelled all the way from Norfolk, hadn't you? So I just felt terrible. And I was led to believe you could get in, so...
Yeah. But no, I thanks a lot, though. And you were really nice about it. Because some people, you do get in those situations and you want them to be a little bit more apologetic. Yeah. Not that I was expecting Julian to be apologetic, because it was in no way anything to do with him, really.
Well, I had invited you and said it would be fine for your children to come. But then, yes, I did actually know the younger one was going to be coming till quite late on in the game.
What filth is in the film?
There's no filth, really. I think it might be just some drug references probably push it into that region, maybe.
Yeah. And how was your screening?
Yeah, it was good. I was relieved. I was expecting sort of... Well, I didn't know what to expect.
Were you nervous, though, before?
I was very nervous, yeah.
Because had it been shown to anyone in the public?
Well, we had
before.
The screenings all the way along the process of editing.
Right.
I mean, I found it all quite disheartening and quite sort of terrifying and scary, and the film being shown, like, to these test audiences with bits missing and
right.
stuff. And
yeah, it's frightening.
I mean, I think it's a good process, but I suppose I thought... Didn't really have a level head about it, I suppose.
Would you sit in those screenings as well?
I did. I went to them, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was quite painful at times, you know, especially in the early ones.
Yeah.
But I'd sort of lived with the film for so long, and
when did you have the idea?
I mean, I think I talked to you guys about it when we first started. Me and Simon started.
Simon Farnaby
doing the work on it initially, which was about seven or eight years ago.
Yeah,
and then when we finally made it, all the dreams of what it could have been and this and that and the other were all reduced to one sort of baggy version. So that, there was no more possibilities anymore. And it was that moment of going, oh, all right, so we've got this, have we? This is what we're going to make into the film, rather than all that sort of stuff that was in your head. But no one knows what that was. No one's seen that, of course. So then we started putting it together, and it got it to, as I think, as good as it could be as an edit. But I'd sort of, then I'd, at that point, I was so drained of any sort of joy from seeing myself and in the main part, trying desperately to sort of become objective about it. I don't know, I just sort of got worn down, and then I couldn't see what I was doing as being a very important part of the film, but I didn't want to start being really arrogant and going, well, of course, my performance will carry a lot of this stuff. And carry some of the problems I was fixating on were the structural stuff, the stuff that we were desperately trying to fix, failing to sort of see that it's basically you're in a funny outfit and you're running around and falling over and doing stuff. Mm-hmm. That sort of allows you to forget about some of those gaps and things. So I sort of was just so relieved when it went okay that I felt great afterwards.
Oh, well done.
But then I was down again when Adam...
Adam ruined it.
Adam sort of took the edge off that.
Well, I think it's amazing that everyone loses their way making something, whatever it is. There's always a point, isn't there, where you're like, I don't know what this is anymore.
Yeah.
And it must be doubly hard if it's your face that's in it.
When you start fighting for stuff and it's your stuff you've done, little things you've done, you sort of feel like, God, what am I doing here? I could do that if it was an actor, you know. But if it's yourself, no. But this bit's great. Yeah. This thing.
Look at my brilliant, funny face.
Look at my amazing thing I did. You idiots. So it's hard. It's hard, yeah, to do that, I suppose. And so I did actually. Eventually, I sort of let down. I let other people just sort of look at and be a bit more objective about it, I think, in the end.
Did you ever consider using someone else to play the main part?
I think we did, yeah. I mean, I totally mooted that and put that out there initially as a thing and to Simon. And, you know, he was saying, no, it's got to be you. I mean, that was the initial idea. He sort of came up with the initial idea, the kind of Galaxy Quest idea of a kind of naive, deluded sort of race of aliens or what have you, mistaking a fictional hero for a real one. And so that was the initial thing. And then Simon said, oh, you'd be great as this actor who used to play a detective.
And then who were you thinking of? Bergerac and people like that?
Yeah, Bergerac...
John Nettles.
Shoestring. And all those shows. So it was great because we could just dive into all that. And initially, we were so excited about being able to replicate that era of show. And we thought there was going to be a lot more of that in it in the end. But as we sort of went along, we realised it became more about an actual real character and his arc. And all the other stuff sort of fell away a bit, in a good way, I think. You know,
well, yeah, but that's often the way, isn't it? That one idea is the launch pad idea. It's like it's the one that gets you up and running.
Yes.
And then you often have to sort of leave quite a bit of that behind because it was only there to get you up and running.
Yeah.
But I saw a picture of you online. I haven't seen the film yet, but I saw a picture of you with you've got an eye patch.
Yeah.
Is that the idea? I remember you saying that you could see the truth.
Yeah, he's got, you can see the truth, yeah. I mean, he went through various iterations. He was eventually, at one point, he was going to have a nose that could smell the truth, like a special, special nose. We thought it could be a terribly conceived idea because it was a show that didn't work, so it could be really badly conceived. But I think there was something...
Right, the show in the
film. Actual show that we were parodying, that we were...
Yes.
That he'd been in, which had been a disaster back in the day.
Yeah.
We thought could have been anything. But we wanted it to be a bit more believable, and I think the eye patch sort of had a sort of heroic element, and the nose was... We went through a few ideas for that, but yeah.
And where did the name Mindhorn come from?
Well, that came from initially from a friend of ours, Ollie Ralph, who's in a band, Ralph Band.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a character he did once on a Bush radio show, which was called Bruno Mindhorn. And he played a sort of weird Belgian poet character and he just wrote some weird things. And then he wrote a song about Bruno Mindhorn. And then Simon was listening to his album and thought, oh, that sounds like a detective, Mindhorn.
Yeah.
From the 80s. So that's where the name came from originally.
It's a great name.
It is a good name.
You guys are good. You and Noel were always very good at doing odd names for things. Who was the Ladder Coins? Who came?
Gosh, I don't know.
That always used to really make me laugh, the Ladder Coins.
Yeah, we...
They were a band, weren't they?
They were, on the radio show, I think.
I love it, that thing of when a name will just stick. It's like a good idea for something.
Yeah.
It just won't go away.
And there's nothing worse than a bad one. Sometimes when you try too hard...
Yes.
They're so painful. And then you hear them...
I found myself doing that the other day with a script. For about half an hour, maybe even an hour. God, I don't know. Just going, Trevor. Trevor said... No, not Trevor. Steve. Brian. Barry.
Yeah.
So I had about 20 pages, and then I just kept going through Find and Replace and changing their names... through the script, see how it felt when I read
it. I'd spend days on that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah,
because I find once you've got the name...
Everything else slots in.
It really
then you
does.
Then you try Hannibal.
Yeah. Try those
just
crazy
weird,
names.
Sort of weird names.
Louis Cypher.
Yeah.
I mean, God, there's some people who are happy to go with Louis Cypher or, you know, John Horizon. Or
what? There's not a John Horizon.
I'm just picking that out. Okay. Yeah, there could be. Or Don Protagonista.
There was a receptionist, or a security guard, really, who he worked at a production company, and he had a name tag, and it was, I don't know what his first name was, but his surname was Noodleman.
Oh, yes.
And I was like, just all I've done since I met that bloke was try and find
a project
where I can call someone Noodleman. And finally, in this film we've just finished, there's a character in it called Nana Noodleman. And she's this elderly character, and she has a grandson called Eddie Noodleman.
She's voiced by Joanna Lumley. No.
Jennifer Saunders.
Jennifer Saunders, yeah.
Well, she's actually voiced by two Jennifers. Jennifer Saunders does her speaking part, and Jennifer Hudson does the singing.
Right.
Yeah. But that name, Noodleman, I just love it.
It's great.
Noodleman.
Get me Noodleman.
Get me Noodleman.
Matt Berry and Arthur Matthews are very good at names in Toast. And they've got quite a formula, I think, which is just more or less marrying boring first name, Christian names, with inanimate objects.
Right.
And that works quite well. I've used that in the past. And
give me an example.
Well, one that I had that I was very fond of for ages was Carol Spatula, who was a sort of playwright.
Yeah.
Carol Spatula's new very upsetting play.
No, but it's a good formula, like Dennis Lamp.
Yeah.
Quite good.
Me and Joe, it was always things like Julie and Donnie is one of my favourite ones.
I like Judith.
Judith,
that's
is good.
A favourite of mine, yeah.
Yeah.
We got a character played by Rhea Perlman called Judith. She's a llama. And Rhea Perlman, you know Rhea Perlman.
Sure, right? Yeah. From Cheers.
Yeah, she was fantastic. But I just love hearing Matthew McConaughey saying Judith over and over again. Judith, hi. Just hearing him say Judith feels like a triumph.
I like the name Judith because for me it reminds me of Life of Brian. Him being so embarrassed about Judith. And then when she stands up, their mum walks in on them shagging Terry Jones, you know.
Yeah.
She stands up and she's got her big undergrowth
70s.
On display.
Yeah.
And she's all strident and powerful. And
yeah.
I love the face of Terry Jones in that scene. He's just looking at her up and down. Like, utter just horror and indignation.
Oh, it's so good. You know how sometimes there's nothing on TV. I mean, often these days you'll go through and you'll find an old movie that's playing and you'll think, oh, yeah, it's only 20 minutes in. I'll carry on with that one. It's usually something like The Rock for me.
Right.
You know, oh, I haven't seen The Rock in a while. I'll carry on watching that, which according to Adam Curtis in his hypernormalization doc, one of his theses is that early versions of ISIS or some sort of terror cell out in the Middle East watched The Rock, the film with Nick Cage and Sean Connery, and looked at the way that they dealt with chemical weapons in there And there's a whole scene where he talks about the string of pearls configuration when he's pulling it out of this canister. And you remember it's all the little glass spheres and they're green and they've all got green liquid.
Right.
And it's like if one of these spheres landed on San Francisco, it would kill 10,000 people instantly and all this kind of stuff. So Adam Curtis reckons that some guy watched this film and then said, or made it, like, leaked out the information, we've got chemical weapons, and to prove it to you, this is how they work. They're in a string of pearls configuration, and they're in little glass spheres, so you better watch out. And then that became part of the dossier that was handed to Tony Blair, and it became part of the reason that Tony Blair was convinced that we had to invade Iraq.
Oh, my.
Because they had weapons of mass destruction.
Is this really in the documentary?
Yeah. I mean, it's Adam Curtis's things are like essays more than documentaries. So it's his. This is him weaving some kind of truth
out. I love the sort of the idea of fictional stuff impacting on the world in some strange psychological way, like the way we sort of seem to be making Star Trek come to life, or we make sci-fi. Yes. We're somehow planning what we're going to do with these fictional imaginings, you know, so we're sort of creating stuff because we've visualised it already.
Right, exactly.
And that's like a negative version of
that,
isn't it?
Yeah, because like the Donald Trump character being like the Paul Verhoeven vision of the future.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Like that's right.
I'd buy that for the dollar kind of... Yeah. You always were watching that going, well, that's a funny idea, but it's never going to be like that. And it really is.
It's almost as if... And I, by the way, I'm probably misattributing who came up with what. It may even have been someone in the American government that watched The Rock and then attributed that information to the Iraqis. Or I can't remember exactly, but that's more or less the implication was, in some circuitous way or other, it was the fucking Rock that indirectly helped Tony Blair make his mind up to invade Iraq. And you do sometimes feel as if various aspects of culture are sowing the seeds, laying the groundwork.
Yeah. It's a shame it wasn't like Desperately Seeking Susan or something like that. Just something a bit more fun, like My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yeah.
And then I thought, why don't we do that instead? Instead of The Rock.
Yeah. It's okay, weird how they get some things right, obviously, and some things are completely not seen at all. Like the internet is never seen in any film.
That's true, it's not,
is it? Hover boots or it's robot butlers, but it's never it was never the internet.
There's aspects of it. I mean, if you look at 2001, he's doing a Skype call to his wife.
That's communication, isn't it?
I know what you mean, though.
Yeah, that's not the internet. The idea of being interconnected in that way, isn't there?
I think that's what I meant, this sort of idea of all the information being somewhere.
I think there are hints of it every now and again.
Well, the George Orwell being the main guy in terms of predicting where things are going to go, right?
Yeah. Well, 1984 is a good example of a thing that wove itself into the public consciousness to such a degree that it was almost as if people were willing it to become reality. It was like, here it is, it's coming, I told you it was coming, here it is. No, it's really coming now, it's going to be worse next year, watch out, here it is, fucking it's Big Brother. I told you it was coming, it was bad last year, it's fucking way worse now. It just carries on. But I guess that's just something in human nature, isn't it? It always ends up with that paradigm of there being some despot who has some superficial veneer of, I'm going to look after you and you have to just do what I say.
That's how I'm running my family.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's the thing, is that family dynamics, so you often feel that they get expanded into system of governments.
Yeah.
And you know, you sort of think, well, sometimes you've just got to tell the people what's going to happen just to sort them out, like I do with my sons.
We're halfway through the podcast. I think it's going really great. The conversation's flowing like it would between a geezer and his mate.
All right, mate. Hello, geezer. I'm pleased to see you.
Ooh. There's so much chemistry, it's like a science lab of talking.
I'm interested in what you said.
Thank you.
There's fun chat and there's deep chat, it's like Chris Evans is meeting Stephen Hawking.
If my dad was here now, he'd be saying, you know what, this is going to burn off.
It is going to burn off.
He'd be looking up at the sky and he'd go, this will burn off.
We're walking now.
Should have worn your shorts today.
It's a lovely autumn morning, but it's quite misty. And
I'm not here. I'm being put on afterwards.
Yeah.
But with a bit of Foley and...
We're going to add Julian in post.
Some breathing.
So...
And it is, Garth's right, it is definitely the kind of weather that's going to burn off. The sun is...
I'm plucking a blackberry off the bush. Yeah, just to...
Yeah, actually, just the right... They're still good.
Quite... Ooh.
Oh, mate.
I thought those...
You're going to eat it.
That's nice.
Yeah.
They look good.
We picked some apples off our little apple tree.
I tried those apples.
It was amazing.
Yeah, I was expecting them to be a bit, you know... A bit tart.
Yeah.
No, they're great. Delicious.
It was really good. And there was no way I was going to have one because I don't like supermarket apples a lot because they're too tart.
Right.
I gravitate towards the jazz apple as regular listeners will know.
I love the jazz apple.
And I used to love the Fuji because that was similarly sweet, but the jazz is even better. But Sel, my wife, said, you should try one of our apples. And I just said, no, that's not going to happen. No way, why would I? Because also they have little... welts in them, things you don't get in on supermarket apples, little blemishes.
Yeah, you're allowed those though.
Yeah, but I'm so thick and childish that I didn't even consider eating them. But she lampooned me and
held you down, stuffed an apple in your face.
She stuffed an apple in me like a little piggy.
Yeah,
and it was really great. I guess it's partly that thing that people say you know, if you grow something yourself and you taste it, it tastes extra special.
Yeah.
That must be what cannibals were into it for as well. It must.
Yeah, homegrown food.
You know.
You had that sort of
if you
pride
eat like a nice
own...
guy,
yeah.
You just think, hey, you know what? This is delicious because he was actually a terrific bloke.
Yeah.
Although they were usually eating their enemies, weren't they?
You would think, yes.
Where was that most popular then, that whole...
Cannibalism.
Was that sort of New Guinea or somewhere like that?
I mean, is it even a thing? Or was it an
it
old...
It was a thing.
Aztec sort of ceremonies of sacrifice and then eating an enemy... gave you his power, perhaps.
Ah, if you eat their heart.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking of the Temple of Doom with the Kali. But they weren't they a real tribe, the Kali?
I think... Now, you see, this is... We're going into the same area as The Rock and George Bush. And
but it's possible,
though... It's real. There's a real Kali tribe. We've got to go to India and get them out of the mine.
There's some crystal skulls.
Yes.
Well, there are some crystal skulls, aren't there? I think there are crystal skulls. I don't think that you can hide in a fridge and expect to survive a nuclear explosion,
which is
what Indiana Jones does.
Yeah.
At the beginning of that.
Do you know I never even got to that bit?
Yes, I did. I do remember that.
So it's such a weird feeling to watch, a peculiarly modern feeling to be excited about something to that degree, and then from moment to moment just to be denied pleasure. Denied, 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 slap, 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 slap. It's really weird. It was all it was weird because you can obviously the original Indiana Jones film is not based on accurate physics and science.
Yes.
But they didn't push it. They knew how far to push it.
Do you mean the supernatural element, the alien element?
Everything about it, all the, you know, the physical stunts and getting dragged under a truck and all sorts of little bits. It's cartoonish, yes, but you go with it, and you're happy to go with it. Whereas Crystal Skulls, you didn't want to go with anything. Well, I didn't.
Yeah.
I always liked the fact that in the first one, all the mysticism surrounding this supposed arc, Indiana Jones, he was having none of that. He's like just some hocus pocus, you know.
Uh-huh.
I love the fact that it was at the end. Right at the end, he's like, oh, my God. You know, and initially when you open that thing, it's just dust. That's another great thing. So even when I was first watching it, thought, oh, it really wasn't anything. And then...
Yeah. Melty face.
Yeah.
Garth, you were on the Skywalker Ranch doing the post for your film.
Honestly...
Are you able to describe that?
It's a very, really super relaxed, very busy, lovely environment. And I should explain, it's predominantly a sound mixing facility. It's these great big sound mixing studios. But the building that they're contained in is nestled in this valley that George Lucas owns, this entire valley. And it really is like, if you picture a beautiful valley covered in vineyards and olive groves. And
Northern California.
Yes, Northern California. It's just north of San Francisco. And I've always dreamed of going to this place. It has been a dream of mine to be able to work there. And it just so happened that the studio I'm now working for always have a tradition of finishing the mixes up at this
Illuminations.
Illumination Entertainment. They always finish their animated films up there. They finish the mix there. So I got to stay there, but it was unbelievable just how great it was. You drive for miles through this sort of windy roads with redwoods either side.
Yes, and where they filmed scenes from Return of the Jedi and stuff.
You can see where the inspiration came from, really. I mean, if that was his home, he was thinking, oh, we should do it here. And it really is lovely. And then you turn up at a very nondescript gate, then you go down this beautiful sort of country lane, which is all part of his estate, and then you come to the guest area. It's like a little mini village, a very, very small village of cottages and apartments, ranging from a very small room, if you're just staying there overnight, to places like mine, which are like a little apartment, like log cabin style buildings. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it all smells of that lovely sweet wood, and there's beautiful trees everywhere, but it's very small and cozy. And you go and check in, you get your key, and you basically live there while you finish the mix. And you get on your bicycle with its little basket on the front, and you cycle up through the lanes, up past the farmyard. You end up going past Lake Ewok, which he dug out, and you could swim in that if you wanted to. It's so nice.
Mm. Does George stride about in a sort of...
He does, apparently.
Walking,
I didn't see him while...
a crop and a sort of sampling
on a horse. It's like a gaucho.
Sipping wine.
Mm, this is ripe.
He is
this wine needs more CG.
He's around, but I didn't see him. And the deal is that you don't go up to him.
Uh-huh. Right.
No one says that to you, but you just can feel that being like, that would be very uncool here.
Yeah.
Like one morning, I got up. There's a communal kitchen. It's very nice. You have to, there's no like, you're not pampered. It sounds like you're pampered from what I just said, but you have to cook for yourself and look after yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was very hard. No, but it's great because you go into one of the communal kitchens and, you know, do some eggs or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was making some coffee early one morning. I noticed that one of the people that worked there had got some donuts and stacked up a stack of donuts. And I thought I was the only one there, and I was laughing, looking at these donuts going, I think I said out loud something like, only in America would you have this for breakfast? And this voice said, I know, right? And I turned around and it was Jodie Foster.
Whoa.
Sitting, just making notes, doing her thing. She was mixing, I think, Money Monster at the time.
Yeah.
But it's walking along with you now, it sounds like a really pizzazzy, starry moment. And I was very, very taken to meet her because I really think she is phenomenal in every respect.
Great.
And but because this place is so super laid back, there's none of that Hollywood atmosphere there. It's very much like being in a sort of farming community and just getting things done. And so you end up having a nice chat and she goes on her way and does her thing and you do yours. And it's only when you write home that night or you phone up, you go, yeah, I saw Jodie Foster this morning.
Yeah.
We were just having a cup of coffee. It was amazing. And the facility itself, the sound mixing studios, are just incredible. And I've never had that level of technical amazing brilliance.
Uh-huh.
It's phenomenal. They have a cinema there where you can go and check your mix as if it was in a real cinema. It's a huge 400-seater cinema with the greatest sound system in the world. So you wander in there at lunchtime and you go and play it back. And you're like, wow, that sounds a bit loud there. But half the time, I'm just sort of almost breathless with just joy at being there, really. It's really, it never, there wasn't a single day where I wasn't bowled over by what we were doing. And the people are so nice. They're like sort of Ben and Jerry's kind of characters.
Very nice, hippie-ish.
Yeah, really laid back. Hey, how are we doing? They've seen everything. They've dealt with every filmmaker from James Cameron through to...
every type of Wally.
There were some great James Cameron stories. Apparently someone said, James said to one guy, let's call this guy Bill. I don't know who it was who he said this to. This Bill's doing something on his film. He goes, Bill, you and I have the same size head. How come you're so much dumber than I am? Yeah. So I used to love hearing all these stories.
That's a good line.
Yeah. I'm going to say that to my children when they're a bit older.
Exactly.
No, there were lots of lovely filmy character anecdotes you would get along the way. But generally, people that work there have worked there all their lives because it's such a lovely environment.
Sure.
It really is spectacular.
Do you see people in the distance getting sort of removed and shot? No, but I mean, is there...
No.
There must be some sort of, quite a lot of security, I would have thought, unless it's far away from...
It's very, very far away from anything. It really is.
They must have nerd lasers there and stuff, just to pick off the...
Well, here's the thing.
Because, the nerds will find that place, won't they?
You would think.
Well, here's the thing, right? It's a very nondescript road and a very nondescript entrance. And even when you got in, there is a security guard, but it's so laid back. Yeah. It is not like going into a movie studio.
Do you think it's a sort of hidden, there's a hidden sort of, you know...
Control. Like Disneyland, where it's like, it's not this good for nothing.
It's an affable front, you know.
But. And that's the place where he keeps all the old bits and pieces of paraphernalia and models,
right,
etc.
That's the one thing I didn't get it together to do.
Right.
It's tricky to go and look around there. It's not like something you can just tour. But I'd been there long enough, I thought maybe I could ask. But I ended up being so busy with it all.
Have you ever seen that stuff?
What, the...
The little museum of all the
Star Wars. There are some things. There's a main house there. That you can get your lunch. There's a canteen up at this big, beautiful main house.
Has it got aliens in it playing jazz?
Not quite. No. But you go in there and there's Indy's hat and there's Charlie Chaplin's cane and all kinds of amazing movie memorabilia and a library like you've never seen. The most beautiful library with reference books for everything. And it's really very special. That was the biggest treat of the entire last 5 years for me.
Yeah. And then how have your previews been going? Has that process been... Because you're all totally done and dusted now, right?
Just finished.
Nothing else you can do to it?
Nothing else I can do now. It's done now.
It's too late.
Got to let it go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how are you feeling about it?
I feel really good about it.
Do you feel like you've got any kind of perspective on it? Or?
Yeah, I do now. But we had two sort of public previews where you just invite anyone in, families. You try and find a mix of people, and they know nothing about it.
Yeah.
And both times that was to about 400 people, and both times they went really well.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time on both occasions we hadn't finished the film. They were still huge chunks that were in storyboards, you know, sort of very crude animatic kind of versions of the scenes. That all was fine. But then the big one, the big terrifying one, was our first proper invitation screening, which was at the Toronto Film Festival in September. And that was really an extraordinary experience because I was very nervous in the run-up to it, obviously. There were 2,000 people in the audience. So quite a lot of the cast had come along. Some of them hadn't seen it yet. My wife had come along. She'd never seen any of it. Not a bit of it.
So which cast members have you got there?
That came to Toronto was Matthew McConaughey, Scarlett Johansson, Reese Witherspoon, Taron Egerton, Tori Kelly, Jennifer Hudson and Nick Kroll.
Right.
Yeah.
And good turnout.
It was a good turnout. And just really, you know, I was very violently ill earlier in the day.
From nerves? Or?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you get like that?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Because it's just too much. It's just a bit too much. But then once I got up there and introduced it, I felt a bit better. But then your heart is in your mouth. I mean, you just had your premiere, didn't you, at the London Film Festival?
Yeah.
And do you not find those first few minutes?
I was ready to leave.
Yeah.
At the beginning, I didn't fully sit down. I was sort of hovering above the seat. I just thought if it just carries on and no one's laughing, I'll just quietly
go,
slip out,
away, and. Probably just change my name, and, you know. But I sort of gradually lowered myself as the laughs came, and suddenly I thought, you know, it's okay. People are getting the joke, getting the idea of the film. They're getting because it's a thing of looking at it in pieces, isn't it? For so long,
yeah.
Which you just it's so hard to see what that thing is that is keeping it aloft, and often it's not in any of the individual pieces that you've been examining. So long.
It isn't, is it? It's the greater...
Yeah, which you can't... It's somehow... You can lose sight of what that is or forget it or...
Yeah.
So when people start to see that again, it's like, oh...
Yeah.
That, you know, it has got through to them.
And did you
somehow.
Feel... Did you? Were you relieved at that? Did that feel good?
Yes.
It does.
It felt very good, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was... I didn't realise I'd been quite sort of weighed down by the... I sort of didn't see that it had been... It had its grip on me for quite a while. I didn't realise until that moment it started to evaporate. I was like...
Oh, I feel sort of light. Yeah. What is this feeling? It's quite
good. I remember seeing you earlier this year, and I remember the two of us were quite anxious about what we were doing. But when I walked in and saw you the other day, it was like a new man. Ah. Yeah, even if I hadn't known
already.
I've
had a bit of work done as well, of course. I mean, as the premiere ended, I was off to get my...
Get your face all
face
inflated.
Tightened and...
Well,
yeah.
It was exactly the same. It was a very frightening sit down. My wife sort of gripping my hand because she's a tough critic as well. She won't hold back.
I mean, I hate to add that this isn't... I feel relieved now because I think I've seen it with an audience and they enjoyed it and I felt like it connected. And
yeah.
Whether that works in terms of,
I see,
you know,
right.
Who knows whether that's going to translate to being successful or anything like that. But I know in that, just even for that one screening, it was like, it's almost...
Well, you know it can work.
Yeah, and I think that's the sort of, it's up to the gods, you know, as to what happens.
Exactly.
Whether it catches the right kind of thermal.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like, reminds me of a live, you know, after a good gig, you had that sort of feeling of it connecting. And,
yes.
But then often there would be bad gigs as well. And it's quite sort of interesting to see how differently films play. I sort of took, in a way, having done live stuff and finding the same show going down badly and well in different places and blaming myself for it. Yeah. It's quite interesting to see something that is exactly the same go badly and well in different places and go, oh... So there's a sort of something else going on here that maybe was going on back then.
Well, there's a chemistry in the audience as well, though, isn't there? And you see that at live shows, definitely, when there'll be a loud laugher sometimes and they can positively infect the rest of the audience.
Yeah, that's what they need to employ those guys at screenings.
Yeah, just one or two of those.
Sort of little...
You don't want to go too crazy because sometimes you can get a too idiosyncratic a laugher.
Yes.
Yeah. And then everyone's like, whoa.
Yeah.
And everyone's laughing at that.
And everyone makes
waiting for that laugh.
Yeah, waiting for that guy to do his funny cuckoo laugh.
You hear it on radio comedy programmes sometimes. You're thinking, who the hell's that? But and then sometimes the opposite is true in an audience as well. There's just a little frosty group. Yeah. Everyone's all self-conscious.
I feel exactly the same way, though, that I don't know how the film is going to do out in the world.
And
I have no control over that. But the three times we've shown it, especially the last time, it did everything we wanted it to do. And if anything, it really exceeded...
Your expectations.
Yeah, oh, God, it was very emotional at the end of the Toronto screening because there's two things going on. There's this enormous relief at having finished something after 5 years.
Yeah.
And there's people, they were literally out of their seats dancing at the end and cheering.
Oh, wow.
It was great. And there was this sort of excitement of like, wow, it did work. And like you said, though, it may not work somewhere else or it'll go up and down in terms of how it's received, depending on the audience. But it was a great feeling. And then that's why I got really sick afterwards because I just realized, I'm done.
Yeah, you just crashed.
Crashed, yes.
But you said, like, you sort of went back to work fairly quickly after finishing Sing.
Yeah.
And you were all emotional and
it was ridiculous. Yeah, I didn't realise. I just thought, I'll keep going. I'll keep working on other things. I just had this rhythm that I'd been running at for the last few years. And I kept going on this other stuff. And I was on a Skype call with this lady called Dana. And all she said to me was something like, yeah, that idea works. And what about if you moved it up earlier? And as she was saying this, I could feel my heart rate going. Like, oh, God.
Dana!
And I started going, you know what, Dana? Whoa, I'm going to have to not do this. And she was just thinking I was being a bit silly and sort of said, no, it's fine. I'm not saying anything big. Just change it. I'm like, I don't know what's wrong with me right now. And she said, why, what's wrong? Don't you like this idea or, you know, the thing? And I didn't see it coming. Otherwise, I'd never have gotten a Skype call. I just started welling up. And going, I'm really sorry. Paul welling up. Weller. Yeah, it was really, really, really...
So you started blubbing.
And I felt very embarrassed and stupid.
Quite right.
And she was very sweet, and she got a bit upset too. And I said, I think I need to stop.
This is what it's like in the high-powered film business, is it? Just people...
Sobbing
on Skype calls.
Pathetic. It's pathetic. It's embarrassing, really.
It's nice. I think there should be more crying in business.
But anyway, I rang up the team I'm working with and I had to say, look, I'm really sorry, but I was also feeling really run down. Mm-hmm. And I said, do you mind if I take some time off? And they were very good. And they said, sure, go and do your thing.
You've been replaced, though.
Been replaced, yeah. Well,
we've replaced you with someone that doesn't cry.
Yeah.
When we're trying to work.
Yes, that's crying.
Okay, you're a really great guy, but pro tip, generally, we don't cry while we're working.
We don't cry about seeing animals. There's really...
What we do is we keep the crying for when we're... for private time. So you went and you did the John Lennon time off, bake some bread...
Is that what he did?
Yeah, he after the Beatles for a while, he...
God, that's exactly what I did.
He stayed in the Dakota with Yoko and he learned how to bake bread and he spent time with...
Yeah, I did a lot of cooking.
Sean.
Yep, did that too.
Not with Sean, obviously.
Just was a house husband, you know?
Yeah, I was a house husband, so I could just do all the food and all the school runs and it was great. That is a good tonic, actually. Just basically other people being more interesting and important than you are for a bit.
Right, for a little bit.
Yeah, that's then, very good.
I don't like that.
Yeah, then you can marginalise.
I don't like that. It's not good. Even if I'm doing a school run, I remind them that I'm more important than they are. Just before I drop them off. Yeah.
Have you ever cried in a professional situation, Julian?
No, I don't think so.
No,
only in Noel and I, sometimes we would have, if we ever had sort of arguments, we'd quite quickly make up and they quite often be tears.
Oh, really?
That's nice.
Tears of sort of like, sorry, mate, I don't know what...
Huggle.
No, yeah, that's great.
Just, you know. And you'd sort of have a bit of that. Could happen quite easily.
That's good.
Yeah.
Make-up sex.
Not in there.
That's what you want. That is the secret of being a productive duo or unit of any kind, is being able to do that. You don't want to...
Hold on.
You don't want to hold on to the tension, no.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that Joe and I were that good at doing...
Did you have a few makeup tears?
Not... I don't think tears, no. We only got to the wavery voice stage. Wobbly voice.
Yeah.
And so we'd be at wobbly voice.
Do you think we need more of the sort of, you know, Metallica, the therapy?
Is it,
Yes. Metallica, was it, that documentary?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, Making a Monster, was it?
Yeah, the sort of bringing together of, I think it could be good for a lot of creative partnerships, you know, to do that.
Well, it's served them well, hasn't it? I mean, they're still putting out stuff. And
it's a lot of unspoken sort of energy, isn't there, and when you're in a team. And it can go, it can drive you forward and it can sort of go wrong. And it can, by definition, almost, you're not grown up. Yeah. Because you're sort of still playing dressing up and lots of...
Right.
You're sort of maintaining a sort of childlike... energy, which can work and then not work, and you don't know why it's not working. And I sort of, I think maybe you could check into some therapy as a group, as a double act, you know.
My worry would be that you'd
lose the comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you suddenly see why it
you'd
is you're doing what you're doing.
You'd start tiptoeing around each other. You'd be too respectful, and then...
You're triggering me with that setup. You've set up... I'm setting up too many of you, Joe. It's becoming a trigger from my childhood, from setting up things, and I felt...
You didn't laugh hard enough when I suggested that idea. Well, earlier on today, we were talking about the way that you deal with other people's ideas in a creative situation, and how you often get people who think they're being sensitive, and I'm sure I've done this myself, and you think, no, I don't want to just totally rubbish that person's idea. So I'll start off by saying, that is a great, great idea, which is very funny and interesting. We're not going to do it. And then you move on to something else.
That's the thing. I read somewhere the writer of Castaway, geezer who wrote the Tom Hanks film. Yeah, he just said something about he'd written the film, but it'd taken him something like 7 years to write. He said, so... He just said, I've spent 7 years writing this, so it's not that you have to like it, it's just that if you don't, just don't tell me.
Yeah.
That's what he was saying, you know.
Sometimes I feel like I wish trashing things was more frowned upon. Like, this is just in little moments, because it's obviously fun trashing things sometimes. But I always think if people understood that it's not cool to trash something, even if you think it's absolutely shit.
Is this in public? This is like
a fantasy scenario. Like, imagine what would the world be like if this was how everyone behaved. You don't have to lie. You don't have to pretend you like something if you don't. But the understanding is that you only enthuse about things you genuinely like. So you apply that to the kind of critical landscape. And in fact, that's what some Word magazine, I don't know if you remember Word magazine, but that when that started, that was their philosophy, was that they would only write about things they liked.
Yeah.
And that they could enthuse about.
I don't know. I mean, I think anger and stuff's great as fuel and in terms of making stuff and what gets you angry and stuff. So, but in terms of, I suppose, like, isn't a critical, in terms of reviews and criticism and
that
how does that help things to...
I just think the culture of reviewing being some kind of respectable art form is totally out of hand now. So that if you go online, everyone wants to be a critic and everyone is setting themselves up as some little reviewer of every kind of thing you can imagine. And they're really into it, and there's people doing these long, in-depth, very wordy reviews. And I'm sure some of them are perfectly insightful and have many valid points to make. But you just think, God, there's more to life than this, surely. It's more fun either to make something or to enthuse about something rather than to sit there going through, here's 50 reasons why the new films from so-and-so sucked and didn't make any sense. You know? It's exhausting.
I remember there's a guy, I don't want even him to know that I know who he is, really. But he wrote quite a bad review of the Boosh. But I went to a gig, I think it was a Ennio Morricone gig or something, and afterwards came out and I was with some friends and he was there. And he went, oh, hi.
Name of critic withheld.
I said, oh, yeah, you actually wrote a really bad review for us, didn't you? Yes, I know, and, you know, I've since watched The Boosh and the whole thing now, and I think I was right.
Wow.
And I was like, what? And I think I swore and got quite angry, and then my friend sort of pulled me away slightly. But he was, you know, admire admire his balls for the sort of cold, just... Yeah. Thing. I mean,
did he actually come over and say hi?
I kind of think he must have done, because I wouldn't have gone over to him or knew who he was. But I just remember that moment, and then, yes, I sort of fumed about it for a bit. And they once showed The Boosh to on a show, like they're showing Bernard Manning, some sort of modern comedian.
I remember that.
See what he thought of
him. Alternative comedy.
Showed Bernard Manning The Boosh, and he said, what do you think of that? He went, at least I haven't got a fucking clue. About as funny as a bird in an orphanage. I quite like that. At least I haven't got a fucking clue.
Wait. Continue.
Oh, look at that sunset, Rosie. And there's some clouds as well, making it even more spectacular. Well, I guess we should head home. I think it's tuna pasta tonight. Maybe an episode of Homeland. It was Line of Duty last night. With DCI Buckles. It looks nothing like me. And in Homeland, of course, we have Mandy Patinkin playing the part of me. Yes, I'm aware that I look a bit like Saul Berenson. I've got a video where I inserted myself, or rather I put my mouth over Saul Berenson's face in a scene from Homeland and used it as part of my live show. It's not on YouTube, but it will be available to download at some point. My live show, that is, which incorporates various videos that I've made over the last 4 years or something. And I collected them all together in a show that I called Adam Buxton's Old Bits.
because it sounds like I'm talking about my genitals. That's funny. I mean, I'm aware that it isn't funny, and I did try and think of another title, but I honestly couldn't think of a better one. That's not very good, is it? Anyway, at some point, that will be... That's been recorded. We taped it earlier this year at the BFI. I should have waited until summer. Everyone looks sexier in the summer. Don't tape things in January when you're getting over a cold and you've just been eating non-stop cakes for 2 months. I'll let you know when that's available to download. It should be fairly soon. Only a few weeks. Thanks to the good folks at Go Faster Stripe, who do Richard Herring's bits and pieces, and Stuart Lee, and lots of brilliant comedians. But I will let you know about that when it happens. Don't worry, I won't shut up about it. Thank you very much indeed to Julian Barrett, who was a little bit nervous about being on the podcast. He's shy and modest and doesn't like to go on about himself, really. So I was really pleased that he agreed to have a mic pack strapped to him while we went for a walk. And thanks, of course, to Garth Jennings. I'm sure he'll be back to let us know how his sequel to Sing is going and just talk about life in general at some point. Thank you very much indeed to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for production support, and to Matt Lamont for conversation editing. I'll be back same time next week. Till then, remember that I love you. Bye. Like and subscribe. This is an advert for Squarespace. Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right. Stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No. It's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul. And I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts. And I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.